to start by just clearing up a few misconceptions. Because contrary to what a lot of people believe, workers aren't just burly white men in blue overalls. A worker isn't defined by their accent, their dress code, their income, or even their alcoholic beverage of choice. Being a worker actually just means that you sell your labour, your work, for a wage. And in fact, in Australia, about 70% of the population are working class. And, you know, this can only make sense when you understand that the working class is not just construction workers and plumbers, but also teachers, nurses, you know, call centre workers, university lecturers, and so on. Now, it is the case that in Australia, lots of working class people don't necessarily identify as such. So my mum is a teacher, and she swears to me constantly that she is middle class. But I suppose just as you don't need to understand the theory of thermodynamics to feel cold, you don't actually need to identify as a worker to be one. The thing that actually unites these people is that they're subject to rigid discipline. That from, you know, whatever hours they work between, they're told where to sit, where to stand, when you can take a break, when you can go to the toilet, you know, like in some industries like retail and hospitality, you're even told what facial expression you need to adopt. You need to pretty much smile all of the time. And when you sort of put it like this, it sounds like some sort of dystopic nightmare. But this is just the daily reality for work for most people around the world. And we have no option but to accept these conditions, this discipline. Because unlike James Packer, most of us were not born with $1 million already in our bank account. So you have to work to pay the bills and to survive. And really, it's a profound injustice that the people, the 70% of people in Australia and, you know, the massive amounts of workers across the world, the people who make everything in our society, who build the roads, who provide the electricity, who teach in the schools, work in the hospitals and so on, none of these people have any say over how or what they work for. And instead, they're expected to work like robots or, as Marx put it, wage slaves. I think there's lots of examples of what this enslavement kind of looks like. But one of the most recent kind of cutting ones is the workers at the Fukushima nuclear reactor plant in Japan. These workers were made to wade in knee-deep puddles of water, which they were later told, much later, that this water contained 100,000 times the so-called mythically safe level of radiation. And this isn't some sort of horrible mistake either. You know, James Hardie Construction in Australia knowingly used asbestos for years and years. Thousands of workers are expected to endure sexual assaults at the hands of their bosses. And, you know, dozens of workers die on construction sites every year in Australia. This is all just part of the job. So that's the first thing. Then on top of this, workers are actually stolen from on a daily basis. So think about it. The capitalists, what do? They don't actually do anything. They buy the materials, they buy the labour, the workers, and then, you know, they sell the outcome. Well, these materials don't just magically transform into value themselves. So what the workers do is actually key. They transform metal into cars, books into knowledge, and so on. They create value. And they're not the beneficiary of this value. The boss is the beneficiary of this value, or in their terms, this profit. The worker just gets a wage. And this wage represents just a portion of the amount of value that you've actually produced. So if you get like $20 an hour, you've probably produced about $100 worth of value in that hour. And the $80 that the boss walks away with in their pocket, that's what's called a profit. Okay. So, workers are hard done by. But then, you know, so are third world children, homeless people, and many other groups in society. So this doesn't actually explain why socialists go on about the working class. I think the key thing is that workers aren't just victims. They actually resist. Now, from the boss's perspective, workers are just commodities that they buy on the market like every other thing, like the materials they use as well. But there's a small glitch with this for them. And I think Henry Ford, of Ford, put it the best when he said, "It's to my perpetual annoyance that every time I ask for a pair of hands, I get a human being." So this is the first thing. Workers are not actually robots. They are, in fact, human beings. And since that's the case, they resist. They can and do resist. But when they resist, they actually have enormous social power as well. So it really matters. When they resist by refusing to work, they can stop the flow of profits altogether and stop the system in its tracks. And this is the power which makes workers the best fighters both for their own wages and conditions, but also against all of the atrocities that capitalism metes out. So I think this is the most important thing. For people who want to challenge the world today, want to challenge the power of multinational corporations, neoliberalist governments, racist leaders, and so on, you actually have to identify the power that can bring these things to their knees. And if you think about it, workers can deal with every problem facing the left today in Australia. So refugees, well, workers could simply refuse to construct or repair detention centres. Climate change, workers could simply, refuse to mine the coal and uranium. It's not as if Twiggy Forrest or whoever would get out there themselves and go down and grab it. And then there's war, The American military machine is seen as the world's last superpower. It has more might than all of the rest of the world's armies put together. But if American soldiers, who really are just workers in uniform, refuse to go to war on behalf of their ruling class, all of this military hardware cannot just kill people on its own. The whole empire would crumple. Okay, and this isn't just abstract fantasy either. I hope those things will happen. But this does happen. And one of the most recent examples of the wonderful power of the working people is the revolution taking place across the Arab world, but particularly in Egypt today. I want to talk a little bit about the background to that revolution, because it didn't just come from nowhere. It actually came on the back of a wave of strikes and protests which started in 2006 and which involved up to 2 million workers throughout those years. So people probably heard from Anand Gopal talk a little bit about this, and particularly he referred to the district, the city Mahalla, where a lot of these strikes were centred. So I just wanted to go through one of these strikes in Mahalla. So on December 7th, 2006, 3,000 women textile workers didn't show up for work. Instead, they congregated in the city square and in the centre of Mahalla and then marched to the plant where they were supposed to be working, shouting, "Here are the women, where are the men?" Within the space of a couple of hours, 10,000 workers were on strike and the whole plant was shut down. Okay, so this went on for a couple of days, and after a couple of days, the management came to them and offered them a pay rise. And this was about half the amount that they were actually asking for. The women workers literally laughed in their faces. One male colleague put it, "The women almost physically tore apart every representative from the management who came to negotiate." It gets better. They cleared up any ambiguity over whether or not they were serious about this when they showed up the next day with makeshift timber boxes carrying over their heads and chanting, "We have the coffins ready for the management." So lo and behold, 2 days later, management returned, giving the workers every single one of their demands, which included a 300% pay rise. Wow. And really, this was actually just the beginning. Copycat strikes exploded across the country, and most of them won their demands as well. And more of these actions as they increased were also accompanied by, people doing street protests, lighting on fire effigies of Mubarak, and so on. And the impact of all of this was enormous. For the first time in years, the working class showed that they could actually challenge the regime of Hosni Mubarak. As one WikiLeaks cable from the US embassy stated, "In Mahalla, a new organic opposition force has bubbled to the surface. This may require the government to change its script." And this new opposition very much sprang into action, as part of the revolution this year. Many of the activists involved in the revolution this year first got involved during those strikes. And actually, most accounts say that in the end, it was the general strike called on the 9th of February, which really tipped the balance against Hosni Mubarak. And it's also these same workers today who are, not just content with the symbolic beheading of the regime, with getting rid of Mubarak, but are continuing to strike, continuing to struggle for social and economic justice. So, okay. Well, on one level, it all seems kind of easy when kind of set out like that. Like, the workers far outnumber the capitalists. We have enormous power. We have the power to bring down dictatorships, for Christ's sakes. So the glaring question that emerges from all of this is, well, why are we still living in a world run by, warmongering, exploitative capitalists? And I think to understand this, we need to understand that the ideas that dominate our society most of the time are the ideas of the ruling class. And that the ruling class spend enormous amounts of time, money and energy on promoting certain ideas and values. So, for example, we're taught from a very young age that we need to submit to authority. We need to go to bed when we're told, not talk back to our teachers, and so on. And in some respects, we're not only just encouraged to accept this authority, but we're forced to. Like, if you don't submit to the authority of your boss, you will not have a job. We're also taught from very early on to accept a certain view of history in the world. And we're taught that ordinary people can't really affect change because, you know, politics is something that happens over there, in Canberra, in the White House, wherever, by people that lead privileged lives, who have the right connections, who, you know, got the right education, who have a sufficient grasp on capitalist economics. Like, they alone can understand why the budget needs to be put into surplus. And again, this isn't just an idea. It's also part of a reality. Actually, most political decisions happen without our consent, and even without our knowledge, as WikiLeaks pretty resoundingly showed. And then we're also taught that, you know, the fundamental turning points in history where progressive changes have been won, that these moments have been won by great individuals. So, like Abraham Lincoln ended slavery, Nelson Mandela brought down apartheid in South Africa, John Lennon brought the 60s about, whatever. This is what we're taught. And actually, just out of interest, how many people here were taught at uni or school that it was a working class revolution in Germany that brought down, ended World War I? Or what about the fact that the black working class in South Africa brought down apartheid? Yeah, well, I'm not surprised. And I'm not making these things up either. They did happen. And the truth of history is, actually, that all fundamental progressive changes have not been won by individuals. They've only been won when the masses have entered the political stage, when the masses of poor, working people have actually pushed change. But we're not taught this. And I've got friends studying modern history at uni today who, like, thankfully the Egyptian Revolution has sort of been crammed onto the syllabus, but you can bet, and I know, that the strikes that I just talked about, which remember involved 2 million people, have not even got a mention. So all of this keeps people from realising their own power. And I think this is really the biggest obstacle, that most people don't actually like the way the world is today, but they feel pretty hopeless to change it in the face of all these ideas. Okay, then there are other ideas as well. Ideas which again come from the ruling class through the media and the education system, which are there to divide us. Things like sexism, racism, and homophobia. Now, I want to make something very clear. These ideas are not natural. They are, in fact, ridiculous. You'd have to be on some sort of psychotic, wild trip to even dream them up. The idea that I share something in common with James Packer because I live on the same geographical landmass as him, or the idea that men and women, because they have different genitals, are fundamentally, you know, can't understand each other ever. Or the idea that a few hundred refugees every year landing on Ashmore Reef at the very top of Australia are going to affect the lives of people in, you know, the suburbs of Western Sydney or Melbourne or whatever. These ideas are totally ridiculous, and they are, in fact, totally artificial. And they're deliberately propagated by the ruling classes, by the ruling class. Because firstly, they justify the oppression that all these groups face, but also they weaken the ability for us to unite together as a working class, which is made up of people from all races, genders and sexualities. But the good news is that these obstacles, you know, these backwards ideas and prejudices and so on, they're not insurmountable obstacles. And actually, because they're so much against the interests of the working class, it's inevitable that they'll be challenged when the working class starts to fight. So obviously, you know, the women textile workers that I mentioned before in Mahalla pretty resoundingly broke through the stereotypes of women as weak and submissive when they went on strike like they did. But I wanted to actually sort of draw out this process in its entirety by giving an example from here in Australia in the 70s. There was a union called the Builders Labourers Federation, the BLF, And this was a union of blue-collar construction workers. And this union pretty much broke every obstacle, every stereotype imaginable. So they were one of the first unions to get on board with the Equal Pay for Women campaign, despite the fact that they only had a handful of women members. They stood up against homophobia when they refused to build at Macquarie University because Macquarie University had expelled a student from dorms for being gay. And this action actually led to the student being readmitted. They fought for and won the first Aboriginal land rights claim when they refused to demolish Aboriginal housing in Redfern. They confronted the tide of Australian nationalism when they went on strike against the Vietnam War. And this is one of my favourite. In 71, they campaigned against apartheid in South Africa. When the all-white South African rugby team came to Sydney, they organised to go onto the pitch and saw down the goalpost in the front of thousands and thousands of people. And then, the BLF was actually the first trade union to introduce something called green bands, which became pretty famous after that, and lots of people took them up, which was about taking direct action to prevent destruction of environmentally significant sites. This was about making sure that parklands and bushland weren't developed. And actually, the fact that we don't live in a totally concretized jungle today is, you know, we have the BLF to thank for that. Places like the Royal Botanic Gardens in Sydney was saved by the BLF, and since then no one has touched it. Okay, so these are a fair few achievements. So what kind of made this union so special, I suppose? Well, firstly, in the decade prior to all of this, they had been a union that had been the lowest paid workers in their industry. And they'd been in a union which was actually controlled by the mafia. Now, left-wing members of the union organised to overthrow the mafia leadership and to reclaim their union. And after this, you know, a tremendous kind of wave of strikes pursued, where they won, you know, wages and conditions and actually became the best paid workers in that whole industry. So after this kind of process, they were feeling pretty good. They were feeling pretty powerful. And the confidence that they gained from fighting for their wages and conditions gave them the confidence to fight for political questions that were well beyond the realms of, you know, what affected them individually. And I wanted to quote one union militant about this. He explained, "The union's activity in the vital matters of racism, peace, pollution and other matters have in no way detracted from the union's attention to improving the wages and conditions and quality of life of members. One is not subordinated to the other, they're complementary." So they, like all of us, who don't benefit from war and oppression and environmental degradation, had an interest in fighting against these things and, you know, most importantly, they had the power to pull it off. Okay, so I've gone over so far the fact that workers do everything to make society function, the fact that they're oppressed and this leads them to resist, and when they do, they have the power to stop profits, to stop business as usual. Now, all this leads me to the final thing I want to say about the working class, which is the fact that they not only have the power to stop production, but to restart it on their own terms and to create society anew, to create a world run by workers without the parasitic class of capitalists who keep us down today. And this world will be infinitely better. So I want to quote another worker from the BLF first off. He said, "Yes, we want to build. However, we prefer to build urgently required hospitals, schools, other public utilities, high-quality flats, units and houses, provided that they're designed with adequate concern for the environment, than to build ugly, unimaginative, architecturally bankrupt blocks of concrete and glass offices. Those of us who build will not be ruled by the developers and building employers whose main concern is making profit." So, workers don't benefit from doing things in the most efficient, cheapest, nastiest, tackiest way possible. They benefit from organising collectively and cooperatively on an equal footing, and they benefit from being able to work creatively. So in a world run by workers, there would be no corners cut, and there would be no wage slaves. But a society run by workers would do more than just improve the lives of the workers. It would liberate everyone. As we've seen, it's only the ruling class which has an interest in propagating divisive ideas, in prioritising profits over the environment, oil over human life, and so on. When the working class takes power, there will be absolutely no reason for them to maintain any of these oppressive ideas and violent institutions. The working class is a collective and a cooperative class with actually no one beneath them to oppress. Now, just to keep things ticking over under capitalism, workers have to work together all of the time. But this becomes even more important when workers decide to fight. So you can't go on strike on your own, but you also, you know, can't win a revolution or a successful wave of strikes by only mobilising one section of the working class. You need a majority of workers who are men, women, black, gay, whatever, to succeed. Now, the other thing that's essential for workers' organisation is democracy. And the working class is an inherently democratic class. Now, even under freaking capitalism, this is true, actually. Trade unions in Australia, though not as strong and democratic as they once were, are by far the most democratic organisations in society today. You have regular elections, you're allowed to pass motions in meetings, speak in meetings, and so on. And this is, you know, this is why socialists support unions. But it's when workers go further than just unions, when they actually make revolutions to overthrow the minority of capitalists at the top, that you get the clearest picture of just how democratic society would be. In every single revolution over the past century, workers have set up councils. And these are like committees elected by workers for the workers. They elect representatives who are totally accountable to their wishes as a majority and totally recallable from their positions. They don't get any extra pay, any extra perks, none of these things. And these councils are the organs through which workers can take power from the capitalists, and they can only do this when the majority agree. So in Russia, these councils went the furthest because they actually took power. Now, a bunch of you probably went along to the session on Russia, the Russian Revolution this morning, but I think it's worth recapping, in light of everything I've said about the working class, just what these workers were able to achieve almost 100 years ago. So firstly, they signed a peace treaty which ended World War I. Now, we have to be clear, this saved millions and millions of lives from the bloodbath that was World War I. They also granted independence, determination to all the oppressed nationalities within the Russian Empire, and they also promoted like linguistic and cultural programs for these people. They granted the right for peasants to take back their land and for all people to expropriate the wealth, the houses, the palaces of the capitalists who'd kept them down. They introduced things that transformed the lives of women in Russia, things like communalized kitchens and childcare. And finally, without any prompting or debate, they decriminalized abortion and granted same-sex marriage in 1917. Things we're still fighting for today, just to point out. Now, these are the achievements of a working-class revolution that lasted just a few years before it was overthrown by Stalin. But these few short years show us that a world run by workers is a world of freedom. And this is the fundamental thing about socialists. Socialists are for freedom. They're for human liberation. And for people who share that, who are against the horrors of capitalism and who are for freedom, we have a responsibility to identify the only force capable of delivering these things. And I'm sure that it is the working class. I'll leave it there.